Thank you. Be seated.
The court is ready to hear oral argument from petitioners in the case of Damon versus Carnett. 25 minutes has been allotted to each side with 10 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, this is James Cronje, and Mr. Bill Reynolds will present argument for petitioners.
Mr. Cronje, may it please the court. I don't know if we've been entered into another useless exercise. We've had the constitutional provision and the statutes which we think are controlling and which should be before the court when we're trying to discuss why we think my former law partner was in great error on the Court of Appeals. It will not be the first time we've had disagreements, but he's announced for re-election, and so I guess he'd be about 6 more years. But in any event, I'm going to ask my putter up on the easel, Bill Reynolds, to see if you can see those. If not, I've caused to be placed before you in typewritten form in the same materials, and it may be better. It just may not be legible from the position of the court. I'm going to put one up there just to see if it's...
Yeah, if I had a pair of field glasses, I could see that.
That's what I was afraid of. The last time we had bigger... Yeah, so if it's all right with the court, well, if we can just make references to these materials that we left with you this morning or left with the clerk.
I
want you to have the tea touch. This is it seems to us, a most unusual case. Mr. Harrison was in the 66th legislature, which concluded his term of office. He was a one-termer, on January the 1st of 81. The contract, which was entered into, was executed in 1987. So on the top of the movie, we can see the cream of the Judge Brown's opinion. That is that when a representative has ever been in the legislature and passes laws under which subsequent contracts are made, he's been banished to Elba. He said that's it. He can never himself enter into a tax collection contract, nor can any law firm he's with. Now, we take two cuts at that proposition, and the first one is this, that under the constitutional provision, that it was not intended by the framers in 1876 to so bar a representative in perpetuity from any contractual interest in which he has zero gain. Let me say, this record has zero gain proof, unlike Strake, in which the Court of Appeals was reversed over 3% emolument voting in the previous session, in which that was some gain, and the court said the conflict provision prevailed and knocked it out.
Mr. Crouser, he really wasn't a member of the legislature when his contract was entered into, was he? Wasn't he a former member of the legislature?
That's, and Cook, that's first prong of our attack, that once you finished your job there on legislation like this, that's the end of it. When you served your term out, and then 6 years later you sign on, you're not bound. I think this is like Spears versus Davis. Judge Spears, I'm sure, will recall that decision in which he and Judge Galloway Calhoun from up in East Texas Tyler, who was a then senator, were both seeking or said wanting to run for the office of the Attorney General on a term, the AG's office, commencing in the January following the conclusion of their terms as senators in simultaneous ending. And they, even though they voted for an increase, or I don't even remember what they voted for, but there was an increase in the emoluments of the office of the AG in the legislature, which was there terminating, when the commencement of the AG would begin a new term. And the court took a realistic cut at the meaning of the conflicts provision and said, even though there's some ostensible possible gain because they voted for a gain, but it's an entirely different office, they finished their term of office, and we would be extending this too long and broadly to hold that they could not seek that office.
Mr. Cronje, I've noticed that some state legislatures will have a rule that you cannot enter into such a contract for, say, a period of 1 year after your term, but I have found no cases that say that you're permanently and perpetually barred. Are there any such?
No, and if you, and it would appear, Cook, that you may have read the Texas Legislative Council's brief in which they have collected the cases from all over, all the states, and how they treat them, and I can stand here and say that there is no state that would begin to hold that a tax contract executed or a similar contract 6 years after that term of office was expired, so it should reach it and condemn the execution. There is a second prong to our case, and that is if you treat the constitutional provision as having some perpetual reach to it, that it can only bar the execution of contracts which were passed during the term of that legislature. Now, it is our position, secondarily, that that did not occur here. That the original law permitting counties or units of government to contract with private attorneys for the collection of taxes was enacted in 1923. And it had a provision in addition to the power to contract that the county commissioners could not contract until there had first been an attempt to get the DA or the county attorney, as the case may be, to try to collect them, failing in which the county could hire outside counsel to do it, to have that step. And this court had held early on, after 1923, that the failure of the commissioner's court or the contracting party to have had that happen, that is, the refusal of the county attorney, the DA, voided that contract. In other words, it was an absolute condition of authority to enter into such a contract. As many of you know, that in 79 or the 66th legislature, the property tax code was prepared, consolidating and bringing everything from the days of the old Colquitt tax law into one code, at which time we had 630C, which is at issue here. At that time, the legislature, that was the legislature Mr. Harrison served, added another requirement before the commissioners could contract with an outside party, in addition to the refusal or the failure of performance by the local attorney. But you had to get the recommendation of the tax collector. Now, we have been taken to task for saying it's hard to assume that this tax collector would have recommended these attorneys for this contract, since he's contested it and it's sitting here today. But whether he would have been nicer than he's been and would have recommended it and got over that hurdle or not is not the issue. The issue and the fact is, when this contract was executed, there was no failure of a DA to perform, and there was no recommendation by the tax collector. So if the law that was passed in the 66th legislature was the controlling law, this contract would be void out of hand because neither of those conditions existed. But after Mr. Harrison finished his term of office, And in the ensuing legislature, he ran out of office in January 1st of 81, and then in 82, the 67th passed the law under which this contract was executed.
Did the legislation passed by the 66th legislature ever become effective?
Well, let me say, can I back up to that, Judge,
sure,
to just complete this thought about under the law of the 67th legislature, which was the law we suggest is controlling of whether there was any authority for this contract, neither the recommendation of the collector nor the failure of the DA to perform were any longer conditions. The county commissioners had their power, and that was the law authorizing the very contract that was executed. Otherwise, it would have been void if you had to have these other requirements. And what stands like patience at the masthead in this case, they don't contend that Mr. Hurd's law firm stood to gain a thing by Mr. Harrison's service in the 66. We don't have 3%, 2%, 1%, or any amount of economic gain. Now, therein, this court in Spirit versus Davis, and I think even in the Strait case, made it that that's the sine qua non of the operation of that constitutional provision, gain, some kind of gain. And they didn't in this case. They just say it's too bad for you, tough luck, because you're for 6 years earlier, you were in a legislative session that passed a tax law. Now the reasoning that, as I understand it, that's employed by Mr. Cornett is that the tax property code of 66 legislature had an express repealer in it that repealed the old 1923 Act. And ergo, the legislature, the 66, was writing on a clean slate, just as though that passed had never existed. And that we can write out the consolidation of all these tax laws and say this is just a new baby we're bringing birth on. And then they say, and it never did get amended, repealed by the amendments of the 67th, because it had a provision that it would not become effective, 66, until January 1st of 82, into the next term. Ergo, we say that means simply that it was not passed in the 66. Wasn't effective, wasn't passed, and it wasn't the authority for this contract. And I'm not certain how they can make and bring forward the 66 Act having these two disqualifying provisions, collector and the DA, into the one that does. I mean, I think that's a mighty jump. But if this court has looked, as it has looked, at the interpretation of the conflicts clause, is not to be totally preemptive of a person's occupation where he has nothing to gain from it. And that's exactly what's the base of the Spears decision.
Well, you're not arguing that simply by eschewing gain, a legislator can avoid the bar of this provision. For example,
now, if it reaches, Judge Heck, one of the measuring things is gain. In fact, both the interpretive commentary and y'all outright in Spears said it should be proscribed by whether or not, what the purpose of the conflict provision was to eliminate the potentiality of gain.
And so your argument is the other way, this provision doesn't bar, and that shouldn't trouble us because he's not gaining anyone.
And we say because it necessarily on its face was never passed in the 66 while he was a member of the legislature. Let me say the decision that has troubled the 14th Court the most was a decision of the Waco court at the turn of the century, Lillard versus Freestone County. Mr. Lillard was not a lawyer, but he was a local politico in that area and was in the legislature that passed the 24th, that passed the law that authorized counties to contract with outside persons for publishing the tax list. I didn't think anything was before my time, but I think that that was a little before my time even, when they used the publication of your name as being a dirty old debtor, a tax debtor, to raise taxes, and it used to have some effect. I doubt if any taxing entity would think it would be very effective anymore. But that was the theory of those kind of tax lists.
Isn't that case totally distinguishable from our case, because he was a member of the legislature at the time he entered into the contract?
Well, not only that, Your Honor, but I think it's kind of important to discuss how the case arose. He was in the 25th legislature at the time the contract was executed. That is, his contract was executed in the 25th legislature. So he was a sitting member of the legislature when it was enacted. But there are other facts that make it pure dictum. His contract that he entered into with the commissioner's court provided that he had to post a bond, $500, I believe it was at that time, before he could collect anything. And it also said the county itself could never be made liable for his services. And they wouldn't pay him because they didn't think he was a Dudley Do-Right. And so he sued the county for those funds, notwithstanding the provisions of his contract, and had never made the bond. The case went up on demurrer, and another vestige of the past. And the court first held that his contract, he couldn't sue on the contract because he had never made the bond he agreed to, and he couldn't sue the county for his alleged advertising because he had expressly agreed he would only collect it out of funds collected and that the county wouldn't be liable. It was only after making those two announcements that they proceeded into the impact and effect of his serving in the 24th and the 25th legislature. Now, the Court of Appeals seized upon the language in that opinion, which I believe is at the last page of the materials you have in front of you, in which the statement is made, "We are of the opinion that this contract was prohibited by reason of the appellant having been a member of the 24th legislature." Now, it is suggested both by Mr. Cornett and by the Court of Appeals that that language, excerpted from the whole of the opinion, is controlling and extends these prohibitions eternally to any member of the legislature that served when anything was done, gain or not. And I think that's just, that's what that is, an excerpt. If you just turn to the next sentence in that opinion, in which the Waco court said, "The law was amended and reenacted as a whole by the 25th legislature. The fees for publishing the delinquent tax list were changed. It may be the change was slight, but whether a change was made at all in this respect, we think the entire law, having been reenacted as a whole in the 25th legislature, was, quote, passed, unquote, within the meaning of Article 1, Section 18. That is square, John, on our position that he made his contract on the basis of a law passed in his administration during his term of office. And I will conclude my thoughts about it. It just seems to me, and certainly seems to the clients, that to suggest that a member of the legislature who served a term of office and who voted for a law that was never the law, never accepted, and the law under which he executes the contract is executed 6 years later after one in the subsequent legislature, is overbroad, discouraging the political office, and it would be one more reason after the vote yesterday why there ought to be a massive walkout over there. And I just suggest that this is an unreasonable limitation, and we would hope the court would correct it.
Under your interpretation of the constitutional provision, was this decision back in 1900 rightly determined?
Judge, if you can take it backwards, I say that this case holds, I say the holding, if it is a holding and not dictum, that the law that under which he contracted was passed in the 25th, and that was the prohibition. The other aspect of it is, I don't see how, philosophically, judicial philosophy, of interpreting the Constitution in a reasonable way, as all the other states do, to say that a guy that didn't have anything to do with the contract he executed and gets no gain out of it, to say he is perpetually barred from ever serving or being in a firm which may be interested in that.
Under your interpretation of that constitutional provision, would it be possible for a lawyer who thinks that 20% is not enough on these contracts to go to the legislature, get it up to 30%, and then at the conclusion of his term to begin contracting at 30%?
Well, Judge, unfortunately, Judge, okay, I don't have that question
there.
But just, this was a 15% contract, never even went to the 20% of the 66 if it had ever come into effect. Well, my answer to that is that if he's gone and he can't vote for it, but only can lobby or whatever for an increase in the percent, why would, well, I don't have the right to ask a rhetorical question to you, but why would that be any different than any other accelerated contractor rights that people are given by legislation in subsequent years? I just don't.
So your feeling would be that would, under the constitutional provision as you interpret it, there would not be any restriction to prevent that from happening?
No, not for a previous term of office he served years ago.
Well, but under the interpretation, if we interpret the Constitution as you're suggesting, you can go to the legislature, pass a bill to increase it from 20 to 30 or 20 to 50 or whatever, if you get it passed, and then at the conclusion of your two-year term of office, you can benefit and gain from that piece of legislation you got passed.
Well, let me say I would trust the legislature in its infinite wisdom to not forbid that, but let me be this forthright about it. That was the issue in Spears, that, and I don't even know how to argue when you say Senator Calhoun and Senator Spears had voted for an increase in the pay in the AG's office and then were seeking it in the very next go-round. I believe you interpreted correctly then, and I believe that's an answer to the question you make. If he didn't have anything to do with it, the subsequent raise, then I don't see how he could be condemned constitutionally. But even more importantly, in Spears, you did have a vote of the senators that increased the emoluments of the AG's office, and they were permitted to run for that office in the very next term. Thank you very much, and your patience again. Pleasure to be here.
May it please the court, Mr. Jerry McConnell, to present arguments for the law.
Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court, the pleading court. I'm Gary McConnell. I'm from Angleton, Texas, and I represent Ray Cornett, who's the respondent before the court here today. I think that, of course, in looking at
this, is Mr. Cornett proceeding in his
official capacity, or is this an individual suit? Or?
He was proceeding in his individual capacity, Your Honor. I think in order to look at what we're up against in this particular case, both as petitioner and respondent, it's sort of like whether you say potato or potato, because there are some magic words here that even I think petitioners pointed out in his application. Those magic words essentially are authorized, passed, and I'll add one more, and that's member of the legislature. Now, it is, of course, a compelling argument to say, how can you prevent someone from being able to contract for the rest of his life because of his service in the legislature? This is a noble endeavor, and we shouldn't punish people because of that. And I agree that that argument, you know, has a real attraction when you just make it in a vacuum. But what we're talking about here today is, what did the framers of Article 3, Section 18 mean when they wrote and enacted, the people enacted, that particular article? I think the discussion about the Spears case, with all due deference to Judge Spears,
sometimes I wish it had come out the other way.
I can understand that, Your Honor. With all due deference to Your Honor, I think that case cannot possibly be read to support the petitioner's position in this case, because it dealt with the meaning of the word or the phrase for the term in which he was elected. And we're not involved with that in this interpretation, and that is why we have the problem. Because, and this is why I claim that in looking at a reasonable interpretation of this particular amendment, you must look at the whole amendment in order to determine what the framers intended. So the first thing you look at is, you see when they're talking about precluding a representative or a senator from seeking an office in which he participated in increasing the emoluments thereof, there is an express limitation as to the bar. That is for the term for which he was elected. Now, what petitioner wants you to do in this case is bring that down to the last phrase, down to the bottom, and interpolate, add that to that phrase so that it reads basically that the bar would not apply if for the term for which the member of the legislature was elected, that would preclude him from entering into any contract that was authorized by a bill passed during the term for which he was elected.
Well, if you read this whole clause in its entirety, doesn't it appear to be concerned with legislators' conduct while they're members?
Yes, sir. I agree with that. But it also includes, I think, by virtue of the fact that the obvious omission in the last phrase, it includes not only the conduct while they are legislators, but it extends it. Because then you get into what were the conditions that were prevailing at the time of the enactment of the 1876 Constitution, and the interpretive comment that follows that in annotated statutes, about there being an intent on the part of the people to make sure that a group of legislators didn't get together and enact legislation where they could then take advantage of it. Well, if you limit it to the term for which they are elected, what's to prevent those same legislators from enacting favorable legislation and then, after their term has expired, either not seek re-election or not be re-elected and go out and seek the very benefits that they helped enact? To even make it perhaps maybe a little more absurd, but take it to the very end of the legislature and have it all passed at that time, and then their term expires 6 or 7 months later, and then they can immediately take advantage of that particular legislation.
And that's a troublesome scenario, but in this case, we've got an amendment the next term that this legislator did not participate in. So why should that trouble us?
Well, now we go from constitutional interpretation down to the actual statute. And this, I think, requires a different consideration in terms of how you go about looking at whether or not the particular law was passed or whether it was authorized in question. I don't understand the petitioner's argument that this law that existed either both at the time the 66th legislature enacted the Texas Property Tax Code or as it might have been amended by the 67th legislature is not the authority for this contract. Clearly, this is the authority for this contract because the former sections, former articles 7335, 7335A, were expressly repealed by the 66th legislature when they enacted the Texas Tax Code. Now, as I read all of the cases that talk about the effect of a repeal, is it abrogates the former statute, and for any actions, for any interpretations that are to be made thereafter, it's of no force and effect.
So if in the 67th legislature, instead of amending the statute, they had repealed the prior version and then reenacted a subsequent version, then that would not be a bar to his negotiating the contract.
Exactly. That is the distinction. And I think that's...
What sense does it make to have the decision turn on whether the legislature repealed and reenacted or simply amended when the effect is the same?
Well, I guess that's where we get down to whether or not the authority exists for the contract substantively as a result of what was enacted by the 66th legislature or by the 67th legislature. The Court of Appeals in this case found no material variance between the two enactments. And I don't think that it was even presented to them, to the Court of Appeals, about this matter of whether or not there was express repealer in the 66th legislation or the 67th legislation, or whether or not the effective dates had anything to do with it.
Well, taking out the requirement for the consent of the tax collector is fairly material, isn't it?
I don't think so, because number one is...
material in this case, wouldn't it?
No, I don't know. I can't answer that because the record that you have before you does not contain any evidence that there would have been any problem with any recommendation. What petitioner wants you to believe is that because this lawsuit was brought, that means that the respondent in this case would never have recommended these people as the attorneys. Well, there's no evidence. The record is silent on that particular point, and I don't think that you can read that into a determination as to whether or not, as a matter of fact, that would be a significant departure from the legislation as it was enacted by the 66th legislature. The Court of Appeals looked at these two statutes and said there wasn't that much difference. Now, I added to that when petitioner in his brief on application for writ of error, this court for the first time brought up this contention that 6.30 as it was enacted by the 66th legislature never became law. That's when we get into whether or not these actual dates were effective. I think you have to look at the whole legislative history of both 6.30 as it was enacted by the 66th legislature and it was as it was amended or changed by the 67th legislature, because it evidences no intention on the part of the legislature to repeal or reenact 6.30. It made some changes, yes, there's no doubt about that, but it did not change the authority for the entry of this contract. As a result, and as the Court of Appeals held, there was no material change, and the change that was made did not constitute a reenactment or an implicit repeal of what the 66th legislature had passed.
Well, let me be sure I understand. If the 67th legislature had simply said 6.30 is repealed and then reenacted it in hack verba, that you would say that the Constitution does not bar the legislators' participation in the contract in this case?
Well, I'd certainly have a bigger hurdle to overcome by making that argument, because I think procedurally there's no doubt in that case that the 67th legislature would have been the law passed by that legislature would have been the law that would have authorized this contract. But that didn't happen.
And unless that happens under your interpretation, this is a lifetime bar.
Yes, Your Honor. Yeah, it's my interpretation, and I think that interpretation is borne out not only by the literal reading of Article 3, Section 18, but by the Lillard case.
And applying that interpretation, if the next time the legislature meets, they rewrite the education code, there'll be a lifetime bar to anyone who serves in that session having an employment contract with the education agency?
Well, of course, it would depend upon the literal language of the particular code as it was enacted.
You're talking about the literal language of the Constitution.
Yes, sir. I'm talking about the literal language of the Constitution, but when you get down to the statutes, I think it depends on whether or not the literal language, the language of the statute comes within that, because it involves whether there was a contract that was authorized by the legislature in which the, and passed by the legislature in which the affected legislator was a member. So I can't answer that. Certainly, if there was a contract authorized by that particular passage, then they would be barred from life by this literal reading of Article 3, Section 18.
Counsel, let me ask you about that literal reading of Article 3, Section 18. Can you not also interpret it to mean that the limitations period for which a senator or representative is barred is only during the term for which he was elected?
You can only do that, Your Honor, by using the term member of the legislature and referring from that use of that term that it was intended to create a bar for the term for which he was elected, because that language does not appear in that phrase.
Well, which has been my... Are you wanting to read into the language of the Constitution, or shall any member or former member?
No, Your Honor, I'm not. Although I guess I could be accused of being guilty of the same interpolation I've accused the other side of by doing so, but what I'm saying is that by member of the legislature, it was the intent, based upon the conditions that prevailed at that time, that such a bar continue beyond the service of the member of the legislature.
Yeah. Legislative history on that?
No, Your Honor, that is what I think Lillard holds. And counsel read the particular section of Lillard that he thought ought to apply in this case, and what I'd like to do is to take it up a few lines above what he mentioned, because this same argument was being made by Lillard to the Court of Appeals back in 1900. And the statement reads from the opinion. At page 340, appellant insists that his term of office as a member of the 24th legislature had expired and that the amendments to the law made by the 25th legislature did not materially change the pay for publishing the delinquent tax list, and hence the above provisions of the Constitution do not apply. Now, taking out the part that was obviously would not be relevant to this proceeding, but he made the same argument that because he was not a member of the 24th legislature, and because the contract was entered into after the end of that particular legislative session, he shouldn't be barred from entering into this contract. The Lillard Court answered that by saying, we are not willing to admit the contention that appellant's term of office having expired as a member of the 24th legislature, he thereby became authorized to contract with Freestone County by virtue of a law passed by that legislature. We think it apparent that the intention of the above clause of the Constitution was to absolutely prohibit any person from entering into a contract with a state or county authorized by a statute passed by a legislature of which such person was a member. Such being the case, the intention should be given effect. Then they go on to say, we are of the opinion that the contract is prohibited by reason of the appellant having been a member of the 24th legislature. Now, it's no doubt that had they stopped there, I'd be standing here waving that opinion before you, because I think that would absolutely stand for the proposition. Unfortunately, the court went on and said, well, at any rate, because it was amended by the 25th legislature and reenacted, then we think that he's barred by virtue of being a member of the 25th legislature. So but what I'm saying is that at least from the very first time that this argument is advanced in the 1900 case, the Lillard Court had no trouble saying this prohibition applies even though you're not a member of the 24th legislature, and the authorization arose from that legislation. We still think it applies, and you're absolutely barred thereafter because of the application of that Article 3, Section 18.
Of course, under your reading of it and under your interpretation, it doesn't make any difference as to whether or not the member of the legislature voted for the legislature.
No. No, I think that's clear.
Now, is it reasonable to assume that the makers of the Constitution intended to impose a mark of Cain on a member of the legislature, that he would have to wear the rest of his life for the actions of some of his colleagues that he had nothing to do with?
Well, whether it's reasonable or not, I guess, depends upon whether the intention of the people at the time the 1876 Constitution was adopted could be read to require that.
I just question if that's a reasonable interpretation for now.
Well, I think, and as I've cited in my brief, in at least several instances, Now, this only applies to constitutional interpretation. The case law has said that this court, in interpreting the Constitution, must do so without regard to the consequences. It must be an interpretation that is based upon the standard as set forth, I think, in the director of...
And looking at that standard, has there been any investigation, historical analysis about what the ratifiers are, the framers of this particular subsection contingent?
I can find none, Your Honor, and I've looked. The only legislative history, of course, appears after in the annotations, and the only case law that's ever looked at this from the last clause of Article 3, Section 18 is Lillard.
Well, there's a lot of other ways.
Was it the debates or any of the discussion in ratifying the Constitution?
No, I have not looked at that.
There were several hundred daily newspapers in Texas.
Well, I would only...
Daily or weekly newspapers that, for lack of a better copy, a lot of them talk about the Constitution.
I would represent to the court that I have read extensively some historical treatises about this period of time, and for whatever reason, this particular amendment was not considered important enough to comment on. Had I found something to support my position or the other position, I would have been required, of course, to set that out in my brief, and I certainly would have, but I could find nothing historically that addressed that specific section. Historically, there seems to have been more concerned about other matters that went on during the Reconstruction period and the post-Reconstruction Constitution. Going just
provision in a lot of other state constitutions?
That's what I'm going to address now, Your Honor. As the Legislative Council's brief, which was incorporated in the petitioner's application, makes clear, there are seven other states that have similar constitutional provisions. And I have looked at all of the other states, and I think that the Texas Legislative Council's census there is correct. Now, the problem with the other states, though, is that, as they point out, only one other state's constitution, that being West Virginia, has the identical language that Texas Constitution has. And there are no cases under the West Virginia Constitution that addresses this particular bar that's being asserted by the respondent in this case. The other state constitutional provisions all carefully limit the bar to either the term for which the affected legislator serves or for a specified period of time thereafter. So I guess to the extent that the other state constitutions and the writers of those constitutions were involved, they were a little more careful in their draftsmanship to make sure that that particular proscription was for a definite time. There are a number of states that simply adopted conflict of interest amendments or constitutional provisions, which just simply said that a legislator shall avoid any conflicts of interest, and then the legislature is directed to enact statutes or statutory provisions concerning those. And that's what Michigan did, as the Legislative Council points out. So there's no help as far as interpreting our own constitutional provision by looking to any of the other states.
Does it mean that five of us on this court were ineligible to run because we voted for pay raises for Supreme Court judges?
I don't know, Your Honor. I haven't made that kind of determination. As to the summation I'd like to make at this particular point in time,